This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and this is our nighttime audience that we're catering to right now. And Kevin Cope, a man who is certainly familiar with nocturnal pursuits, the professor of note at Louisiana State University. He's been at Allen Hall as a professor of English for 41 years, came this way by way of Harvard University. And he was faculty senate president for a decade. And he always is giving us his A game, does not let up, and we're glad he's here. Now, we do want to remind you that our show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge, and the signature sponsor is the mayor's office, East Baton Rouge Parish Mayor Sharon Weston Broom. Good morning, Dr. Cope.
Good morning, impresario of intelligent talk. And I'll tell you, if I give the A game, that shows there's great inflation out there.
No, you always give your A game. And as loquacious guests go, he is at the A number one, as Frank Sinatra would say, top of the heap. And I was going to start on something else, but I mentioned your pedigree at Harvard University. Those universities that are Ivy Leaguers, they're exceptional. I don't think there's any doubt about it. And Harvard is considered to be the creme de la creme, right?
Correct.
Oldest university.
Yes,
in the United States
founded
of America.
By a Puritan bartender. Think how far it's come since then.
Well, Harvard has, of course, produced a number of luminaries in all walks of life, particularly in politics and in literature. You go on, my great literary hero, Norman Mailer, is a graduate of Harvard University. One of my dear friends, Charles Elson Buddy Romer, former governor of Louisiana, Harvard University. The Harvard Crimson, when you arrived on that campus from California, was it a culture shock?
It was something of a novelty. For one, I'd never been in a cold place. I'd always lived in the perpetual sunlight of Southern California. However, it was surprising to encounter a place where there was so much public discourse. The only thing we talked about in California, I suppose, was who was in the next movie. There were actually issues being discussed by people at Harvard.
And you and I are the same era, so this would have been the late 70s, early 80s.
1978, I arrived.
1978, which... Jimmy Carter was president of the United States, and the country, of course, had some turbulent times at that point, as it always does. But we got through them, and I have a feeling we'll get through this 46 years later. But Kevin Cope, right now, college campuses are experiencing some discord and discourse about what's going on in the war, particularly in Gaza. And yesterday, our Speaker of the House, Louisiana's own Mike Johnson, two-time graduate of Louisiana State University. Did you ever have him as a student?
Unfortunately, no. I would have changed some of his views, I think, but he didn't come my way.
Well, he has gone against the grain. He did so on the funding for Ukraine and most of the Republicans in the House, and he represents the Republican majority as Speaker of the House. They voted the other way, including Garrett Graves and Clay Higgins and Julia Ledlow. But yesterday, Mike Johnson was at Columbia University, another exceptional Ivy League school located in a neighborhood in Harlem, Morningside Heights, one of the great universities. And they're the Lions. Harvard's the Crimson, Columbia's the Lions. I once read that a tiger will beat a lion 100% of the time in a fight.
I would imagine so, perhaps because any lion that's walking the streets of New York is probably in a business suit, and that's not boxing attire.
Well, here is Mike Johnson, the LSU Tiger, going into the lion's den at Columbia University yesterday. And you can hear they were not happy to see our swashbuckling Speaker of the House.
A growing number of students have chanted in support of terrorists. They have chased down Jewish students. They have mocked them and reviled them. They have shouted racial epithets. They have screamed at those who bear the Star of David. Enjoy your free speech. They've told Jewish students who wear the Star of David to leave the country. And shamefully, some professors and faculty have joined the mobs.
Okay, well, this is serious business, and I think Mike Johnson is on the right side of the gods on this one. We should not have this kind of display on college campuses, in which we're college campuses of all places, in which we're not open to other people's beliefs, and that would include Jewish people who were discriminating against Palestinians as well. But Mike Johnson, he knew what he was doing. He didn't go to Morningside Heights because he woke up and said, hey, you know, I need to go to Columbia today. This was a political event. And he got treated like a politician, which means he went to a very liberal campus. And he got booed, this conservative from Louisiana State University. Surprise, 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 as Gomer Pyle would say.
I remember Gomer Pyle. I'm old enough. Well,
Shazam.
Golly. Well, I would say that this is probably the biggest crowd that Mike Johnson has ever encountered. You don't see that kind of a mob in Shreveport. But that having been said, of course, you have to distinguish between two things, whether the protesters are advocating violence or harm to others, and that clearly is bad and clearly outside of the bounds. I'll do what the college presidents didn't do and say that that is something that should at least be against college policy. On the other hand, we should not expect people who have got fervid views about this, that, or the other thing, including with regard to some of the extraordinary events taking place in the Middle East, simply to pipe down and be quiet and have tea. That is, universities are about vigorous and fervid debate, no matter what the position is.
Universities are now being accused of tilting leftward and not accepting views from the right. Is there any validity to that, or is that being overplayed?
It depends, I suppose, on a discipline-by-discipline basis. That is, certainly some disciplines are more conservative and some are more liberal overall. But I think if you take a look at the university as a whole from a long view, you'll find that it's pretty evenly distributed. That is, for every person who's in petroleum engineering, there's a person who's in political science, you might say, not to engage in disciplinary stereotypes, but simply to suggest that you need to think about the university as a large organism, which, like the organism of society, is split pretty much 50-50.
Now, listener, knowing you were going to be on the show, and I forgot to alert our ace producer, Robin Dow, but wanted you to respond to James Carville. Do we still have that tape with Carville, who was on the show a few days ago, actually a couple of weeks ago, in which he described what he felt was political correctness at Louisiana State University? He left his post as a adjunct professor at the Manship School because he made a statement that he felt was okay. Now, people listen to that, and they love Carville, but I was surprised at the number of people in our audience who said LSU was right to take exception to the statement he made. But Carville, being James Carville, who's now 79 years old and is, I think, entitled to do whatever he wants in his life, he decided he'd had enough in his old war school. But his quote to Maureen Dowd was, "This is LSU freaking you. It's not Oberlin." But did you sense any kind of friction of that kind at the Department of English?
Well, first of all, with regard to James Carville, I think he's telling the truth. That is, there's a difference between propaganda, aspirations, and realities. And in the case of LSU, all three of those are different things. Certainly, there are plenty of people at the university who aspire to be great. There's a lot of propaganda that comes out of the PR department that is a little bit misleading as to what LSU really is. And then there's the reality, which is that it's a declining, deteriorating university with a whole lot of problems. So I think that once again, speaking, I wouldn't even say what Carville said was fervid, speaking kind of frankly and off the cuff and in an entertaining way about realities as well as aspirations is a great thing. The university should applaud Carville for speaking the truth.
Well, university should be a place where there is great latitude in what is said. But when you attack people for their religious beliefs or their ethnic persuasion, that's not acceptable anywhere, and certainly if you physically threaten them. But I do believe that conservatives, liberals, progressives, whatever, should always have a place at a university to express their points of view. I remember we used to have Free Speech Alley. Do we still have that at LSU, or has that been disbanded as well?
I believe that it exists, but I don't
very
hear much
tepid,
about it.
Very tepid.
Very tepid. You don't see many people anticipating the apocalypse. You don't see many people haranguing about abortion. You just see an occasional person that's got some out-of-the-way view and sort of talking it out in the public street.
Well, we need to have all people represented. And we used to have people who would come to universities and talk and say inflammatory things, famous people, liberals and conservatives. I saw a lot of really, really bright people when I was a student at LSU who appeared at the Union at that time. People like Jack Anderson, the writer. I saw William Proxmire, George McGovern. I think William F. Buckley even came to LSU at one point. So today, if a conservative like Buckley came at LSU, he probably would be welcomed, but probably not welcomed as much at Columbia University.
That is an accurate assessment. I would say that as universities go, LSU is actually fairly conservative. And the real surprise, the real shock is how little engagement there is. That is, we've got a world that's burning up in various ways, whether religious strife or the environment. We don't have any kind of public series going on it.
We'll return after an 89.3-second break with Kevin Cope. This is Jim Inkster, and we're pleased you're listening to the nocturnal version of Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number to dial. But at this point, this program that you're hearing was taped a few hours ago with Kevin Cope. But if you listen to our show, he's a frequent guest on our program, and he is one of the most conversant people, and as I stated, does not hold back, even though he is tenured, as we know. In Louisiana, tenure is probably a bit different than it is in other places, but he has spoken his mind for 41 years at Louisiana State University. He's 66 years old, correct?
Seven. I'm ahead of you.
67 years old. So that's most of your life, and a man who grew up in San Diego and educated. Your undergraduate degree was in that area, right?
In which area?
In California.
Yes, that's right. In Pitzer College in Claremont, California.
And then went to Harvard, PhD. And he is now the Robert and Rita Weta Adams Professor of English.
That's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? Leave it to me to come up with a tongue twister of an honorific.
Well, it's a nice honor, and Dr. Cope is one of those people that LSU should keep as long as he wants to stay. And that's the great thing about academia, is that some of these professors stay until they croak. And I hope you'll be one of them, and I hope you won't croak for a long, long time. But here is James Carville, who at 79 turned in his resignation at his alma mater. He has a law degree and an undergraduate degree from LSU. He's both in the Manship Hall of Fame and the LSU Hall of Distinction. But he got chided for something he felt was appropriate. Others have said, look, even James Carville ought to know better than this. But here is James describing what happened. We're being interviewed by Maureen Dowd, who, of course, is brilliant, but You did say, and I know nobody who loves LSU more than James Carville, but you gave up your gig there because you got offended by the way they treated you. What happened?
Well, you know, the time was up. I told the kids showed them how to open a bottle of champagne properly, and I said, as you extract the cork, the sound you're looking for is, quote, the sigh of a satisfied woman, unquote. Now, that's been part of champagne culture for, I don't know, the last 150 years. And one of the co-eds filed a complaint that made her uncomfortable. In LSU's defense, I think the dean had to close out the file or whatever. But I was like, if I, as a teacher, and I found myself, I was scared to have co-eds in my office. You know, a lot of times after class, I always took students out and go to Geno's or the Julio's, or, you know. And I was scared to even take females because I think the culture everywhere in the country was such that one person says you did something wrong and your whole wife is gone.
And there he is talking about his ire over what happened to him at his alma mater. Should we feel sorry for James Carville, or is he laughing all the way to the bank, Kevin Cope?
Well, I'm sure he's laughing all the way to the bank. I don't know if we should feel sorry for him, but perhaps we can take a lesson from this. That is, who knows what he intended to communicate with his utterance, but he is, as he noted, 150 years in the past, perhaps, with regard to this sort of thing. It probably should have been a little more careful. That having been said, I will note that what he mentions, the atmosphere of fear of accusation, is widespread on the campus. And to some extent, I do some of the same thing. I never meet with students without my door wide open and people around, for example.
Got to have that door open, right?
Yeah. We don't have any kind of surveillance to prove anything there. So you're a sitting duck if somebody wants to act up or bring a false charge.
Now, today, I don't hear the term co-ed much anymore. I've used it on this show, and people have said, Jim, get into the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, words change. You know, first co-ed referred specifically to a female student, and then it described an institutional state of affairs, i.e. there are both genders there, and gradually as that normalized, the need to have the word at all just disappeared. It's not a forbidden word on campus. I'm sure that you could say co-educational and not get into trouble, not like this champagne cork thing, but nevertheless, I think the word has just become obsolete.
Speaking of, the other night I was at a restaurant and I saw a woman who is a friend of mine who's transitioned, and she went into the women's restroom. Well, soon she will be required to go into the men's restroom.
Well,
if Louisiana passes a law, which it most certainly will, what do you make of this?
I would suggest that the legislature and the governor should set something rather more heroic as their goals and what they're dealing with now. Their great achievements so far include such things as discussing the improvement of means of execution and regulating access to the excretorium, that is to say, the restroom. This is not at the top of my agenda. Now, I do understand that people who are in this situation are very sensitive about it, but why other people should get so worked up about having somebody who has transitioned into the restroom is completely beyond me, and certainly we've got more serious problems to address.
And Melissa Flournoy brought up a good point. That also means that men who have transitioned, who now have beards and wear suits, will be going into the women's restroom.
The reality has intruded once again, hasn't it? That is, this situation exists. There are people who have transitioned. So simply putting new signs or new prohibitions on the restroom doors is not going to change reality. Ultimately, what our legislators and governors are anxious about is reality, and they amazingly find themselves unable to change that no more than I can change the orbit of Jupiter.
Here's a story from The Guardian, and to my knowledge, the only place this has been published in Louisiana is with The Lens, which is a nonprofit newsroom in New Orleans, and The Lens was, of course, involved with The Guardian in producing this story, but it's a big story. Big oil uncovered. Louisiana's flagship university lets oil firms influence research for a price. Louisiana State University allowed Shell to influence studies after a $25 million donation and sought funds from other fossil fuel firms for $5 million. Our state's flagship university will let an oil company weigh in on faculty research activities. For $100,000, a corporation can participate in a research study with robust reviewing powers and access to all resulting intellectual property. These are the conditions outlined in a document. It's in writing that LSU's fundraising arm circulated to all oil majors and chemical companies. And records show that after Shell donated $25 million in 2022 to LSU to create the Institute for Energy Innovation, the university gave Shell license to influence research and coursework for the university's new concentration in carbon capture, use, and storage. Your thoughts, Kevin Cope.
As you may recall, with your unsurpassed memory, we first discussed this story right here on Talk Louisiana several months ago when it first broke. And on the one hand, of course, everybody's happy to get some apparent research money. But this is something that, in my opinion, poses a grave threat to both academic freedom and to faculty control of research in the curriculum. It also points out the fact that universities are no longer able to regulate themselves. Because the administration is now a different class of people. That is, the people who are at the top of the administration at LSU generally are not academics. They're career administrators, and they are beholden to other forces, to donors, to the governor, to legislators, to the members of the Board of Supervisors. They are not really capable of regulating in a fair way a research grant. We need to start talking about outside boards that look at the behavior of both faculty and the administration when these kinds of grants come along.
Well, who's responsible for this? Should the president of the university be held accountable? Should the board of supervisors? Somebody had to sign off.
This is interesting. Of course, the PR department at LSU conveniently ascribed responsibility to it for this grant first to the administration and then sort of pointed at President Tate. So it was clear that the administration was eager to take credit for this in the kind of low-key way that they do in academe. So why not show the same eagerness to take some of the blame?
Well, President Tate is the person in charge. Harry Truman said the buck stops here, so we'll see.
And there are 25 million of those bucks in this case.
And Bill Tate came in under John Bel Edwards, and Jeff Landry, of course, is the governor, and he's getting involved in all facets of Louisiana life and culture. My guess is that he, being like any other governor, would probably like to have his, quote, own person there. So if I were Bill Tate, I might be searching for shelter elsewhere.
I have no doubt that he's doing that, or alternatively, that the search firms are working to get him, because the lifespan of a president in the United States is 6 years in office.
We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Hope you're having a good evening. And Kevin Cope is our guest, the longtime faculty senate head for a little over a decade and 41 years at Louisiana State University. And when you hear this guy, he's got to be one of the most articulate, conversant, and loquacious professors anywhere on the planet, and he has chosen to be at LSU. Hugh Buckingham, our dear friend,
indeed,
a guy who probably would not be able to survive in the politically correct world of today. I don't think so. But he said, and he was referring to people like himself and you, they talk about the brain drain at LSU when people leave for other gigs. They may pay more. They may not like Louisiana politics. But there's also the brain remain, as he called it. And you being an aficionado of language, I like that. The brain remain, you and Dr. Buckingham and many, many others.
That is a good little rhyme that has been cooked up there by Buckingham. But you're quite right. That is, I would put a little subtlety into this, and that is that it's a kind of economic educational class difference. That is, if you're in the right position in Louisiana and you're lucky enough, say, in the university to get tenure, you can live and thrive and do pretty well here. But the hurdles to succeeding, especially in the present political and university economic environment, are so high that a reasonable young person probably is going to look elsewhere.
And Mike Wolfe, the noted attorney, the libertarian, is a frequent guest on our show, knowing that you're a student of language and an authority. He, I think, has coined something that is appropriate as the Rolling Stones are prepared to play at the Jazz Fest 1 week from today, next Thursday, May 2nd. He's calling them now, instead of the Rolling Stones, the Strolling Bones.
Well, Mike Wolfe is inimitable and ought to be in the cadre of those who have a permanent place in the English literature. I'm not all that up on rock, and I'm kind of surprised that the Jazz Fest, which ought to be playing jazz, is hosting a famous rock band, but I give it to Mike Wolfe. That's a clever locution.
Maybe they'll play Gimme Shelter in honor of Bill Tate.
Well, I don't think Bill Tate's going to lack for shelter. That is, there's a person who's got a career in front of him. I'll give him that.
Well, I've used that term a few times myself. But where else would his career be? I know what you're saying. Yeah, I know what you're saying. And he's a talented man. And I'm sure he would be marketable if things do not go well in the time at LSU. One thing I like about him, he lives in that house on Lakeshore Drive. You know, King Alexander never lived there. Sean O'Keefe was the last LSU leader to live there, I believe, but Tate moved in, and I like that.
Well, that is a step up, and maybe he's embracing the mid-century modern aesthetic. Who knows? But I agree that it is a good thing to have the campus executive on or near the campus or on a campus property.
And John Bel Edwards lived there after the flood of 2016 that got the mansion, and he didn't want to move. And then somebody pointed out it's actually in the law. The governor has to live in the mansion. So he had to move back.
The governor and Jed Clampett have something in common.
Jed Clampett, Beverly Hillbillies.
All right.
That home, by the way, where the Beverly Hillbillies lived, including Donna Douglas and Max Baer and Buddy Ebsen, all of whom were former guests on our show, by the way. It sold for $150 million a few years ago, the highest home price in the history of the world at the time, to Lachlan Murdoch, who runs Fox News, son of Rupert. So it's a small world, isn't it?
I believe that, and I'm honored to be in the same class of people with Jethro and Ellie Mae.
There you go. Ellie Mae from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Dot Bourgeois, who became Donna Douglas. Now, LSU is going to apparently get the go-ahead and move forward and build a $500 million new arena for basketball. And there are some questions about transparency, and there should be. And I'm not certain exactly how this is going to happen, but those who are doing it say it won't cost much to the public at large. It'll be on public property, but won't cost the public. We'll see. But at the same time, the library is crumbling. And John Bel Edwards, in his final days as governor, said we ought to do a library first. I think he had a point.
He's absolutely right. And this red herring about not costing the public anything is nonsense. It's always a product of money given to the athletic program in one way or the other, or to the Tiger Athletic Foundation or to some other benevolent organization. But that's money that's not going elsewhere. That money could have been given to charities of one kind or another. So there's a finite amount of money in this state, and it's being spent on a basketball arena rather than on learning. That's a disgrace. Yes, Jim, you are absolutely right. Library should be number one.
And we will follow this story with Kevin Cope and others. It is a story that, as they say, has legs. Thank you, my friend, Dr. Kevin Cope.
Always a pleasure.
The Robert and Rita Weta Adams Professor of English at Louisiana State University. And as we head to the end of segment three, we do have two people who are here to talk about kidney disease. And this is an important topic, particularly in this area. We're high on this list as well. LaVarne Burton and Dr. Silas Norman. So here we go. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. And many, of course, in this community and others reflect on particular maladies. And in Louisiana, we have generally a higher increase of things that are bad for us than other states. And one of those is kidney disease. And if you think you might be at risk for developing kidney disease or kidney failure, your genes could provide the answer. Black, African-American, Afro-Caribbean, and Latino, Latinas are at increased risk of having a mutation in one or both of the genes that causes AMKD. AMKD is a form of rapidly progressive kidney disease. And with us is LaVarne Addison Burton. She is president and chief executive officer of the American Kidney Fund. And Dr. Silas Norman, who is director of transplant and multidisciplinary ambulatory care units at the University of Michigan. And good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Well, LaVarne, tell us about this particular risk in which an estimated 13% of Black Americans have two of the genetic variations that would put them in jeopardy of developing kidney disease or kidney failure.
Okay. Thank you so much for having us. And this AMKD Day, which we will observe for the first time next Tuesday, April 30th, is really an opportunity to bring this disease to the forefront and have people aware of it. It's important in thinking about this disease that we all understand that where we and our ancestors came from can affect your kidney health. AMKD stands for APOL1-mediated kidney disease, and that disease is caused by variants in two genes. We all have these genes, APOL1 genes, but if you have variants in both of them, then you may be at very high risk for rapidly developing kidney disease that can result in kidney failure. So this day is all about increasing awareness about this.
Dr. Silas Norman's been on the staff at the University of Michigan for more than 20 years as a nephrologist in the transplant program. Dr. Norman, what should people do as far as finding out, number one, if they are at risk, and number two, if they do have an issue, how do they address it?
So that's a great question. So to the first part of the question, the only way you can know if you have these high-risk variants of APOL1 is to get tested. And so it's important that people have a conversation with their care provider, potentially with a genetic counselor, so they can understand if testing is right for them. You highlighted some of the high-risk groups, Black, African-American, Afro-Caribbean, and Latinos, who may be at risk to have these high-risk variants. And then it's important as people try to minimize their risk for kidney disease or kidney failure that we do things like maintaining a healthy lifestyle, healthy diet, regular exercise, not smoking, minimizing alcohol, so that we're in the best position to minimize our risk for kidney disease.
April 30th is AMKD Awareness Day. And how can someone get more information about whether genetic testing is appropriate?
Okay. We've got lots of information on this on our website at kidneyfund.org/APOL1aware. We want to make sure that people are aware as a first step so that they can take action. As Dr. Norman said, they should also have conversations with their healthcare providers, with geneticists, because you want to know, particularly if you are African-American, if you're Afro-Caribbean or Latino, and you have kidney disease yourself, or it runs in your families and it's not caused by diabetes, then you want to be very much aware and take action for this genetic testing, which is the only way that you can find out if you have these gene variants. And I'll repeat that website, kidneyfund.org/APOL1aware.
And lastly, Dr. Norman, Black people develop kidney failure, I'm told, the data shows, more than four times the rate as white people. Is there any explanation for this?
So there's a number of factors that play into that. We think about the social determinants of health. We think about access to care. We think about institutional racism in the healthcare system. And then we also think about things like the fact that there's a high rate of diabetes and high blood pressure among African Americans, which are the two leading causes of kidney disease. And then as we think about access to care, we know that unfortunately African Americans are often referred later than other groups for specialty care to see a nephrologist, such that for many people, by the time they're seeing a kidney specialist, their disease may already be so advanced that there's not a lot that can be done with it.
Well, we thank Dr. Silas Norman, the board chair of the American Kidney Fund, and LaVarne Burton, president, chief executive officer of the American Kidney Fund. Thanks for the work you're doing and for providing us with salient information. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about this important subject.
And we're headed to the next segment, the final quarter hour we'll spend with Caroline Paul, a fascinating woman. The book is Tough Broad. She's also the author of the bestseller, The Gutsy Girl, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. And speaking of a person who is doing well, as fine wine does, Al Pacino, the great actor who was Michael Corleone in The Godfather. He's 84 years old today, and happy 55th birthday to Renee Zellweger. We're back with more Talk Louisiana after this quick timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and now we're joined by Caroline Paul, the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Gutsy Girl, Escapades for Your Life of Epic Adventure, and Lost Cat, A True Story of Love, Desperation, and GPS Technology. And she is also the author of Tough Broad. That's her latest work, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. And some of us are a certain vintage where we're looking for any edge we can get. And Caroline, you've always filled your life with adventure. Some of those adventures might be a bit dangerous, but it's worked pretty well for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, I am here to speak to you today. I'm excited to talk to you, Jim.
Any close calls along the way?
Yes, sadly. I mean, there's nothing to be proud of. It's, you know, most adventurers, it took me a long time to realize this, but most adventurers don't, you know, really almost want to kill themselves. They sort of manage risk in ways that I did not always do that well when I was young. But I'm 60 now, so I'm smarter.
Well, you're still going, and I can tell, in fine form. And an example, an inspiration for the rest of us in the book, Tough Broad, you dive deep into stories of other people, and one is a 93-year-old hiker, Dot Fisher Smith. Tell us about her.
Well, I actually am really on a quest to figure out how my own fulfilling aging journey is going to look, and I wanted to keep outdoor adventure in my life, but I didn't see women my age out there when I was surfing or on my skateboard. Or I also fly experimental planes. And I saw a lot of men my age and mm-hmm. older, but no women. So it's not really, the book's not really profiles of people. I look at how outdoor adventure fits into the pillars we need for fulfilling aging, like community, purpose, novelty, and health. And so I went and visited Dot because she was a hiker. And she would routinely camp for, you know, 3 days on her own at like 8,000 feet. And she was 93 years old. And she agreed to take me on a walk because I was too nervous to hike with her. I thought she'd out-hike me. and it's just women like that who just showed me, you know, how the outdoors, in this case, it was really clear that just simply being outside is really medicinal. I mean, there's so much about being outside that is actually good for us on a biological level. So,
well, you quote Dervla Murphy, who's a travel author and a solo bicyclist in her 80s. Her quote is, "You're only courageous if you do something you're afraid of doing." I'd say that's applicable to what you're commanding us or imploring us to do?
Well, yes, I think pushing our comfort zones is really where we find novelty in our life. And as we age, novelty can really drop away, but it's really good for our brain, for instance. But, you know, honestly, like I cover a lot of different adventures in this book to look how they will help us age. So I do look at things like base jumping, which is considered the most dangerous sport in the world. It's the one thing I didn't actually go do. I was with Sean Brokman, who was 52, and she base jumped, and I simply was ground crew. But I also go bird watching because I wanted to see how we could get outside no matter what our physical limitations are. And I was with a woman named Virginia Rose, who's been in a wheelchair since she was 14. And she has a nonprofit called Birdability, where she brings people outside because she believes in the power of, well, in this case, bird watching, but definitely being outside to make our lives better.
We're hearing the voice of Caroline Paul, an inspiration who walks the walk and talks the talk, and the book is Tough Broad. It's about her adventures and others, and it's a roadmap for the rest of us. Now, you do these adventurous things, and they require physicality. That means you have to stay in shape. What's your general regimen like?
I really just try to get outside as much as possible. I surf. I get on my electric bike. And that's really good for us, obviously.
Yes, certainly. Women outlive men in the U.S. and everywhere else, but men are encouraged to stay fit, and we have all these supplements. Many men of a certain vintage take testosterone, but yet when I look at the community of men that I'm around of my age, most of them are not in very good shape. Now, your book, you call for women to embrace the same thing men are implored to do, the outdoors in their 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and beyond. And women are not perhaps into chiseled physiques, but at a certain age, that's less important than just general fitness, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's the beauty about getting older. I think it matters less to us. You know, we don't have to be the best. We don't have to win. It's really about the experience. I think when I was young, I wanted to be the first. And I was sometimes. I was the first to mountain bike through Bolivia. I was the first to do many whitewater rivers here in California and around the world. But you know what? That doesn't interest me anymore. And I think as we get older, we that's kind of one of the beauties about getting old. We should like take full advantage of that.
And at the gym, and I'm guilty of this too, quite often we men tend to do things, but we get in these routines and we often do the same things every workout with a few variations. I love your chapter, Ride the Uphills and Downhills. It's good to do different things in different ways, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And again, like one of the things that tends to fall away is we age is novelty. And listen, Jim, I'm the same way. I go to the gym, I do the routine, mostly just to get it over with. I mean, I do love going there, but it's really important to have novelty in our life. And going outside is a really great way to do that. I mean, yes, you can join a book club. And I think actually for men, this kind of thing is more important because socializing for men, I think, gets harder. You know, this book was written for women only because I was really interested in all the negative messaging we get as we age, which I think is different than the messaging men get. I wasn't sure what men got in terms of messaging as they age. So this book, I was worried at how much we limit our life because of what we're told about our aging, which is that it's going to be, you know, full of breaking bones and cognitive decline. And we should be very careful and narrow our life and we're going to be boring. And I don't think men get exactly the same messages, but nevertheless, the book is for men too, for sure. Beyond that one, a focus that I have on looking at how the negative messaging affects women. So yeah, men should get outside because novelty is so important. And again, like the gym is great, but you know, it's really easy to fall into that kind of same routine.
Well, the question that Caroline poses is, why aren't women like men encouraged to keep adventuring into old age? There's not only Dot Fisher Smith, a 93-year-old hiker, but 80-year-old scuba diver Louise Holy, and many other inspirational women. And I would imagine in your voyage, and you've done a lot of risky things, there have been some ups and downs. What's the most challenging thing you've done physically?
I mean, so most of my things that are physical aren't ultimately, it's more the emotional challenges. You know, I fly experimental planes and I've gotten myself into tricky situations because back when I started, there was nobody who, you had to work on your own plane. Nobody they were sort of outside the bounds of like licensing and certification. So you would get these, you would get these questionable aircraft when you would fly them. So I think on a mental level, that was what was more difficult for me than the physical, because frankly, physically, I love working out and I love pushing myself.
Well, it's a book not only about our bodies, but our minds. And one of the chapters is Learn Something New. And a fun quote from Karen Rinaldi, who's a 55-year-old surfer, who says, "It's great to suck at something." Sometimes trying is as important as accomplishing, maybe even more so.
Yeah, I actually interviewed a swimmer who she learned to swim at 68, and she had no outdoor background before this. But she decided, her doctor said, "Hey, man, you need to kind of get in shape. You need to do something." So she decided to learn to swim, and she enlisted a friend. And at 68, they had a swimming journey, and swimming is, you know, that taps all our deep psychological fears about drowning, obviously. So it was a very difficult journey, but super fun for Vijaya Srivastava. And when I met her, she was 73 and she was a regular swimmer. And what she basically said was the journey of learning to swim had opened up her life because it had upended her own expectations of herself. And she had then started to do all these other new things. So anytime you try something new and you surprise yourself, you will, your life opens up, which is kind of powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a quote from Diana Nyad, who we interviewed a few years ago, the first person to swim from Cuba to Florida without a shark cage, and she did it at 64. And Diana says, is a critical life blueprint coming from the toughest broad I know, Caroline Paul. You turn the last page of Tough Broad and promise yourself to spend every minute possible in the great outdoors. Thank you for sharing your story, and we'll be in touch. And congrats
Thank
on
so much,
fighting the
Jim.
Good fight, Caroline. Tough broad.
Thank
yes,
you,
indeed.
Jim. Thank you so much.
And come Friday, as in tomorrow, we will start our show on Friday Politics with the Lieutenant Governor, William Harold Billy Nungesser, now serving his third term. Last two times out, he got more votes than any other person on the ballot in the primaries, and we'll talk with him about what's going on in Louisiana. And we'll also hear from Mark Mallard, who will make his weekly appearance on Friday and give us the latest on the Beltway. Until then, for Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.